And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. As I said in the introduction to this hour, all of us probably know someone or some family affected by stroke. When the blood supply to part of the brain is interrupted or severely reduced, depriving it of oxygen, killing cells, and causing brain damage. This morning, I counted at least four people, two of them relatives, one a professional colleague, another a neighbor, who were either killed by or severely disabled by stroke. Stroke is the fourth leading killer in the U.S., according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC says some 800,000 people a year experience a stroke, and 130,000 of them die. Stroke is also a major cause of disability. In fact, it is the main cause of adult disability in the U.S. Now, a large study from Johns Hopkins, reported this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association, says fewer Americans are having strokes, and those who do are now less likely to die from them. The study closely followed four communities in the United States over more than two decades, one of those communities, Maryland's Washington County. The study found a 24% overall decline in first-time strokes in each of the last two decades, and a 20% overall drop per decade in deaths after stroke. Two of the report's authors join us this hour to talk about it and provide some details and to talk about what it tells us about Americans, our changing lifestyles, and the healthcare system. And please call if you have a question about what you hear during the first part of this hour or send us an email with a comment or question. Midday's phone number is 410-662-8780. Our toll-free number, good from anywhere in the United States, is 866-661-9309. Our email address, you can send us a comment or question that way as well, midday@wypr.org. And we're on Twitter at @MiddayWYPR. We welcome to Midday Dr. Joseph Korish, the G.W. Comstock Professor of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health right here in Baltimore, a specialist in cardiovascular epidemiology. Dr. Korish holds joint appointments in both epidemiology and biostatistics at the Bloomberg School. He also currently serves as the director of the Cardiovascular Disease Epidemiology Training Program, and he's the director of the George W. Comstock Center for Public Health Research and Prevention. So, Dr. Korish, nice to have you on the show with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Also joining us in Studio A is another author of the Journal of American Medical Association article I referenced, the one on stroke, Dr. Rebecca Gottesman, Associate Professor of Neurology at Johns Hopkins, who has keen interest in life after stroke, that is, improving outcomes for people who experience strokes, particularly after cardiac surgery. Dr. Gottesman, nice to have you on the show with us, too.
Thanks for having me as well.
Let's start by describing for our listeners that, Dr. Korish, I'll start with you, the scope of this study. This is impressive. This is a look at four communities, as I said, from 1987 to 2011. Give us a sense of the scope, number of people involved in this.
Yes. So the National Institutes of Health is interested in understanding cardiovascular disease. So it set up this study in the late 1980s and recruited almost 16,000 adults. The recruitment happened from 1986 to 89. And then the participants came for visits, and the visits were detailed and lasted between 4 and 6 hours, including measurements of blood pressure, questionnaires on physical activity, and various imaging studies. And then we've been calling the participants every year, and for the last 7 years, twice a year, to ask about their health status. And they've been wonderful in that over 90% of the participants are still of the ones that are alive answering the phone calls. We have a very dedicated staff that you could imagine after a couple of decades really know many of the participants. And then we find out what happens to people, both by questionnaires and by getting medical charts. And then experts review the charts to validate events like stroke. And then the data are used widely to write over 1,000 scientific papers, and this is one of them.
Wow. What were the ages of these people in this group?
So this study, ERIC, Atherosclerosis Risk in Communities, recruited people in middle age, 45 to 65. And that was in the late 80s.
So none of them had strokes? They had no history of strokes?
Actually, at baseline, they wanted to get a representative sample of the whole community. So we actually use driver's license registration and addresses. And then when we do any one paper, for example, for this stroke paper, we excluded anybody with a history of stroke.
Okay. And Washington County, I mentioned, was included in that. Washington County, Maryland, Jackson, Mississippi, Forsyth County, North Carolina, and Minneapolis, Minnesota. Why was Washington County selected?
So for the whole study, there was a competition for the best scientists and the best communities that would participate and stay involved and contribute to science. Washington County had several advantages. It's actually quite interesting. As you mentioned, we have the George Comstock Center there. And George Comstock had been doing research in Washington County since the 60s. And Johns Hopkins University has been involved in research there for almost 100 years. And the community has been wonderful in that people have been willing to participate, and often people are residents of the county for a long time, so that it's easier in terms of long-standing studies because mobility is somewhat lower.
Let's talk about the good news in the study. What is the good news? I summarized it briefly here.
Yeah, so the good news in terms of stroke is that for the last two decades, the risk and the number of people with stroke has been going down. And it's been going down so that it's about 24% per decade. So over the 24 years of the study, the risk now is about half of what it was when the study started, right? And we can discuss why that might be, but I think for all of us, since we'd like to avoid stroke, that's very good news.
Right. Now, this has been trending downward for a while, right? Dr. Gottesman, there's been other studies indicating that stroke has been on a downward trend in the United States. So what's so special about this besides the scope, the size of this study?
Well, we're able to look both at the ages of people and compare a certain age group and see how that stroke incidence rates in that particular age group changes over time, as well as looking at different stroke rates in different age groups. So we not only see that stroke rates go down, but that they go down within a given age group. Overall, older people have a higher rate of stroke, which is certainly what we would expect. One of the findings of the study, which you didn't emphasize, is that we see less of a decline over time in some of the younger age groups.
Well, let's break it down a little bit. So over 65, how does it look? Under 65, how does it look? Compare those.
So people who are over 65 appear to be having reductions in stroke rates over time over this nearly 25-year period that we're studying. People who are under 65 don't appear to be having the same clear reduction in stroke rates and stroke incidence rates. So the question is why. That's certainly something that we need to think quite a bit about and understand. Do we need to be concerned that this is a pattern in the overall population? Is this something unique to this particular population that we studied? And what can we do to make sure that it's not going up, certainly?
Oh, before we go to the why of the downside, under 65, what about over 65? Why are we seeing fewer strokes?
So we know from our data and also from other reports that more people are taking, for instance, statin medications to control high cholesterol levels. So statins weren't even available at the very onset of this study. Mm-hmm. They were introduced in the early 90s, and we know that more and more people are on them. And actually, the guidelines for who should be taking them has recently changed. In addition, blood pressure management has improved over time. And smoking, which we also showed in our study, has gone down. So fewer people are smoking, which is terrific. Everyone that's still smoking should stop. But we know that smoking rates have gone down. And the combination of risk factor control, reduction in risk factors such as smoking, is probably contributing to some of that reduction that we're seeing in older people.
Okay. And what about the younger people, Dr. Kors? Let's go to the under 65 group. What would explain little change in the stroke picture there?
Yeah, so we're very much concerned about this. And there's some data from other studies that show similar signs for concern. I think we don't know for sure, but our leading hypothesis is that the obesity epidemic and consequent increase in diabetes and increase in blood pressure is really a cause for concern here. And in some sense, if we think nationally, we know that hypertension has actually increased a little bit recently. Presumably because of the increase in obesity. We know that treatment of blood pressure has gotten better, but still we're talking about overall in the whole country, not just our study, about 80% of people are aware of having hypertension who have it. So about 20% of people are not aware that they have high blood pressure even though they have it. Of the ones that are aware, about 3/4 are under treatment. And of the ones that are under treatment, about half are under control. Now, the control rate has improved from 40% to 50%, but I think we're all concerned that we'd like to get higher.
Okay. Let's get the breakdown gender-wise and in terms of race, because those are two things looked at in this study. Gender, first of all.
Yeah, so gender, we generally found similar results in men and women. The improvements happened in both men and women similarly. In terms of race, we also found improvements in the percentage reduction of stroke among both whites and blacks. And that's actually somewhat important and remarkable because one of the previous good studies in the area found reductions in whites, but not in African Americans. And we know that stroke rates are higher among African Americans, particularly at younger age. So seeing a reduction in African Americans is good because we'd like to see reductions in disparities and reductions in stroke rates.
So that's encouraging.
Yes.
And something new, counter to what we've heard in the past. So that's good. Let me ask you this. I'll go to Dr. Gottesman for this question. I said those who are experiencing strokes, who do have strokes, are now less likely to die from them. That's an accurate statement based on the study.
It is an accurate statement. In general, mortality after major acute or chronic illness has gotten better, not just over the last 25 years, but probably over the last century. We are better at providing intensive ICU care, at in general treating acute illness.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically looking at mortality after stroke, in our paper we looked at mortality from a variety of causes. So some people who have a stroke can die as a direct consequence of the stroke. So in the hospital, their stroke may be large enough or severe enough that it leads to death directly because of the brain swelling, for instance, that mm-hmm. can happen after a large stroke.
In this cohort, what percentage would that be?
Well, so we didn't actually look separately at different causes of stroke, causes of death among people who died after a stroke. Generally, that's a smaller percentage. So most people who die after a stroke do not die as a direct consequence of the stroke, but, for instance, have a cardiac complication after the stroke, either in the short-term period or in the months afterwards.
So it's not necessarily related.
Well, it's probably related. So the stress of being in the hospital, they can have problems with their heart rate, for instance, while they're in the hospital. They can certainly develop a pneumonia, which can also be a cause of death. So people with certain types of strokes can't swallow safely, and they may get an aspiration pneumonia, for instance, when secretions or flu or food goes down the wrong way, goes into their lungs. They can get an infection from that, and in theory, that could kill them. So it's related. It's not a direct mm-hmm. consequence. The stroke is not causing the death, but the stroke is putting them at risk for certain types of infections or other complications that could kill
them. A question for the epidemiologist. So if you have a stroke that's disabling,
sure,
and you fall down and bang your head and you suffer a serious enough injury that's fatal, would that be related? Would that be considered related?
Absolutely, which is why we looked at all-cause mortality in this paper.
So you went beyond just death certificates for this study. Actually cause of death beyond the fact that somebody had a stroke, right?
Yeah, exactly. And in this study, what we do is we get the charts for the hospitalization or the death event, or if the death occurred outside the hospital,
right,
we actually contact a next of kin to hear about the circumstances of death. And then that information is reviewed by two independent physicians, and then the causes are adjudicated. So as you said, we have national data on causes of death. But as you pointed out, what gets put down on the death certificate is not necessarily standardized. So if somebody falls and it was because of the stroke, it may or may not get coded as a fall death versus a stroke death.
So the only way to find out is to call and ask questions, right?
Yes, and that's why these studies take time and care, but if you really want to know, you have to study.
This is impressive. 15,792 people ages 45 to 64 in this study. This is Midday. We're hearing details of this comprehensive study of stroke in the United States from two Johns Hopkins researchers, Dr. Joseph Korish of the Bloomberg School of Public Health, and Dr. Rebecca Gottesman, a neurologist with a special interest in stroke. The report was published just yesterday in the Journal of the American Medical Association. If you have questions about this, and we're going to talk about stroke, preventing stroke during this hour of the show, please give us a call, 410-662-8780. This is Midday. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309. You can also send us an email with a question, midday@wypr.org. Wow. Over more than two decades, actually 24 years, this study shows that people are having fewer strokes and dying less often after them. Washington County, Maryland is one of the four communities that was examined in this 24-year study. Very impressive. A paper published on it in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week. Two of the authors are with us, Dr. Joseph Koresh from the Bloomberg School of Public Health here at Hopkins and Dr. Rebecca Gottesman, a Hopkins neurologist. Is the study ongoing? I mean, these 15,792 people, not all of whom are still alive, right?
No. Right. About 10,000 are alive now.
10,000 out of that study group that started, and you said, in 86 and 87 when it was formed. Is this study ongoing?
Yes, it is. And it's actually always a challenge as to when the end should be. But in many ways, we think that the most valuable years of the study have just begun in some sense because Americans are living longer. So the cohort is now ages 70 to 90. And the interesting thing is we know what their health status was 24 years ago. So if they have an event now, we can look at their entire health history and look at how it happens. And we can discuss the fact that measurements early in life sometimes are more valid than measurements late in life.
Could you talk, either of you, talk a little bit about how these communities compared? Say, Jackson, Mississippi with Washington County, Maryland, Forsyth County with Minneapolis. Were any of those comparisons made?
The primary focus of the study is to look at generalizable science and merge them. On the other hand, we do make comparisons, and they were selected in certain ways. So Jackson, Mississippi is all African Americans because we wanted to make sure that early on we had enough African American participants to carefully study diseases, conditions, behaviors that were common in that population. Now, clearly, it's a southern population, so it may not represent all African American communities. But in that community, we had 4,000 individuals, so we really know quite a bit. As you might expect, that community has higher rates of hypertension and obesity. Stroke rates are higher. And we've done surveillance looking at trends over time, and now we see improvements in heart disease incidence, and as we've shown in this paper, stroke incidence as well.
It looks like from the study, tell me if you agree with this, preventing strokes in younger people seems to be what we need to do, and helping older people continue to survive them, right? Is that where the emphasis needs to be, Dr. Gottesman?
Sure. So I think one point which we touched on briefly in this paper, which may explain some of the differences in mortality declines in older people, is that there's differences in how aggressive care is after stroke, depending on how old the person is who experiences a stroke. Hmm. And that's different in the U.S. as opposed to in other countries. So families often make decisions, depending on how large someone's stroke is, as to how aggressive they want to be with extending that person's life at any cost. Unfortunately, some strokes are severe enough that those discussions have to take place. And we know that those decisions are difficult to understand when we're looking at mortality numbers, for instance. So it's a little...
That's interesting. Yeah. You mean the age of a person, for instance, would have a bearing on a family's decision about how to approach this?
Exactly. Right. If it seems that... And many older people have very clearly expressed to their families, if such and such a thing were to happen to me, if I were to get to the point where I cannot make decisions, cannot feed myself, I'm not independent, I would not want you to be aggressive in giving me a feeding tube or other things like that we sometimes have to consider in some stroke patients. Hmm. Most stroke patients, it's not that severe and we don't need to think about those things. But it does come up, and often patients have had those discussions with their families. But it's more frequent that those decisions are different in older people than they are in younger people, which may be somewhat affecting these differences in mortality declines that we're seeing.
Interesting. We've also seen in the last, I don't know, couple of decades anyway, the advent of more stroke centers, medical centers that specialize in stroke treatment, right?
Right. So this has been a big push to have what are called primary stroke centers and comprehensive stroke centers. The comprehensive stroke centers are newer. Johns Hopkins is one. There are going to be fewer of those in the country. But primary stroke centers are meant to be places where people who are having symptoms of stroke are brought. So obviously, when someone has any signs or symptoms of stroke, it's very important to get someone to the hospital right away. There's treatments that we can give people if they come in soon enough after their symptoms, and we can talk more about that if you'd like.
Oh, I think we should.
Okay.
Yeah, we should use this opportunity to go into that.
Absolutely. And that's one big issue. We think people are recognizing signs and symptoms of stroke more recently than they were before, but still people aren't getting in soon enough. So if people come into the hospital either within 3 hours or within 4.5 hours, it depends on who the person is, we have medication we can give, which is called TPA, or tissue plasminogen activator, which was a medication approved through studies by the NIH and then approved by the FDA to give to people who are having an acute ischemic stroke. That means a stroke where blood flow is stopped to part of the brain. Some people who have strokes have bleeding types of strokes, so we don't give this medicine to those people. That's a smaller percentage. But people who are having this ischemic stroke where blood flow is stopped, if they come in soon enough, we can give them this medication that we know is associated with reductions in bad outcomes, reductions in dependence on other people at 3 months and later after a stroke. So,
excuse me. Do we think people, and Dr. Kors, you can add to this, do we think people are more aware of stroke symptoms today than they were 10 years ago, 20 years ago? I mean, do we assume that? Do we have a basis for believing that? What is your opinion of it?
So there are data, and I can look up some of the numbers, that awareness is higher. But it might be useful to have Dr. Gottesman maybe list the signs and symptoms that people should watch out for.
We should
because
do that.
It's higher, but still low.
But okay, I ask that because you're talking about an opportunity that people have.
Absolutely.
If they can get to an emergency room, right, to prevent a stroke, full-fledged stroke. Right?
Absolutely. So the mnemonic that the American Heart Association has come up with is called the FAST screen. So
F-A-S-T.
Yes.
Okay.
So if you are concerned that a family member or a friend is having a stroke, you can think about these four FAST aspects that I'm about to tell you to determine whether this might be a stroke. So F stands for face. So you can ask someone to smile. If you notice that part of their face, usually just one side, is drooping and not symmetric when they smile, they may be experiencing a stroke. A is for arm. Arm weakness is one of the primary symptoms of stroke. So you can ask someone to raise both of their arms. If one of the arms drifts down or they're not able to lift it at all, that may be an indication that they're having a stroke. Arm numbness as well could be another indication. S is for speech. So some people with stroke experience difficulty understanding speech. Other people experience difficulty producing speech. And you can ask someone to repeat a simple sentence such as the sky is blue. If they don't understand what you're asking them to do or can't repeat it or have difficulty getting the words out, you might be concerned that they're having a stroke. And T stands for time. So time is brain. As I said, if people get in soon enough, there are certain treatments that we can give them. And the sooner, the better. So don't go to sleep and think, if I wake up, maybe this weakness on one side of my body will be gone. People do that so much more often than you would think. If you think you're having a stroke or you think a loved one is having a stroke, get them to the hospital, because we can treat them in a very different way if we see them early enough.
This cohort that was studied was age 45 to 64. Is 45 the age when you step across that line, you become 45, and you're more vulnerable, more at risk for stroke?
Not necessarily. So certainly we see some strokes in younger people. Strokes can even happen in children. The causes of strokes in younger people and in children tend to be different than in an older population. So we're talking about stroke rates changing, possibly due to changes in hypertension, high cholesterol, smoking. There's a different set of risk factors which tend to be more obscure and rare that we see when people have stroke at a younger age. I know that a 45-year-old who's very healthy and very physically active and watches their diet and doesn't smoke may be very different from a 45-year-old who's doing all those things who otherwise seems more like a 60-year-old if you really have accumulated a lot of bad lifestyle factors and bad habits.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't really a magic number necessarily where we start to worry about it. That being said, often above age 40 or 45 is when we start to think more seriously about risk factors and whether they're well controlled.
Dr. Rebecca Gottesman, a neurologist at Johns Hopkins with a special interest in stroke, and a co-author with Dr. Joseph Koresh, our other guest in Studio A, of this study published yesterday in the Journal of the American Medical Association, looking at quite a large cohort of people, nearly 16,000 people aged 45 to 64. from 1987 to 2011. You said the top of that cohort now, Dr. Korsh, would be about 90 years old, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Let's take some phone calls. We welcome your questions for our guests in this hour of the show, 410-662-8780. I'm interested in hearing from you if you've had an experience with stroke or a family member with stroke, if you intervene the way Dr. Gottesman was just suggesting people should. If you've had that experience, we'd like to hear from you. If you have questions about this study, please give us a ring. James in Towson has a question for our guest. James, welcome to Midday.
Hi, thanks so much.
Sure.
So thanks so much. This is a really interesting article. You mentioned that one of the ways to reduce risk of stroke is blood pressure control. And we've seen that on the TV, a lot of advertisements for these novel oral anticoagulants, Eliquis, Pradaxa, Xarelto. And I'd like to know what your thoughts are about how these are going to impact the incidence of stroke.
Go ahead, Dr. Gottesman.
So that's a terrific question. You're right. There certainly are a lot of ads for these newer medications. These medications, which are either direct thrombin inhibitors or factor 10A inhibitors, those are the categories, were compared in studies with warfarin or Coumadin for patients with atrial fibrillation. So we didn't really talk about atrial fibrillation or AFib yet today, but that's a condition where the atria of the top chambers of the heart are irregularly beating. In that setting, clots can form, and those clots can then go up to the brain and cause a stroke. So this is why blood thinners are studied in people with AFib, because they're at higher risk for stroke. Most people with stroke are not treated with an anticoagulant, so not treated with warfarin or with one of these newer medications. Often aspirin is adequate, at least for the blood thinning aspect of treatment, in addition to this prevention that we've talked about. So if someone's had a stroke, and we think it's from the very small blood vessels, for instance, from longstanding high blood pressure gradually blocking off these small blood vessels, we often treat them with aspirin. If someone has AFib and we're concerned that they're at risk for stroke from that, they need a little bit more aggressive blood thinner because of the types of clots that form. So the studies that compared these newer medications that are being advertised quite a bit now with warfarin or Coumadin mostly were what we call non-inferiority studies, which means they wanted to see if people did just as well on these newer medicines as they did on Coumadin. Why would we need a new medication that costs more? That
right.
might be your question. Mm-hmm. Because Coumadin is a pain to take, so you need to regularly check your blood levels. It changes depending on how many leafy green vegetables you're eating at a given time.
My mother took it. I was familiar with that.
Right, so it's a nuisance. It's hard to travel because you have to get your blood level checked. Mm-hmm. People don't really enjoy taking Coumadin. And often they're not in what's called the therapeutic range, which means it's as though they're not taking it at all if their blood level is below where it should be. So these newer medications were found, the ones that were approved by the FDA and therefore being advertised, were found to be similar, to be non-inferior to Coumadin. A couple of them looked like they might even be superior to Coumadin. And in general, they had fewer complications such as bleeding because people were bouncing around a little bit less with their levels.
Were they advertised as stroke preventative?
For people with atrial fibrillation. So
for
it's a very specific indication.
Okay, right.
So people with AFib, they were approved by the FDA for people with AFib, and it's to prevent stroke. The couple things that I'm still concerned about as a stroke neurologist is that there's not a clear way to reverse these medications, these newer medications. So if someone comes in with a life-threatening hemorrhage, so you mentioned someone had a stroke, they fall, they have a major bleed in their head, and they die from that.
Yeah.
So that person is on Coumadin or warfarin. We have treatments we can give them to reverse the effect of the Coumadin in their blood so that they don't keep having this extra thin blood. Or if their blood thinner level is way too high, we can reverse it so it's more in the appropriate range. For these newer medications, there is not a clear way yet, people are really working on this, to reverse it. So if someone comes in with a hemorrhage, there's not a whole lot we can do to reverse the fact that the blood is thin. In addition, I mentioned TPA as a really great treatment that we have for ischemic stroke. We can't really give TPA to people who are on one of these new medications because we can't clearly measure where their level of blood thinning is. If someone's blood is too thin, we cannot give them this TPA, which is going to break up clots further. So there's
it's complicated.
It's very complicated.
I'm not confused. I mean, you're explaining this very well, but I'm saying the decisions about medication, this is complex.
Yeah, and the issue of atrial fibrillation is increasingly important. Mm-hmm. And we're doing research studies, including in ERIC, to identify it.
ERIC is this large study that you referred to. Right?
Exactly. And it's quite interesting, even though the population is older now, there are new technologies to actually monitor your heart rhythm for a 2-week period by just having a little patch over your heart and over 90% of the participants in a small pilot that we started liked using the new technology, used it well, wore it for 2 weeks, and we found out both the atrial fibrillation rate that was known to be about 3% of the people, and found out that an equal number of people had atrial fibrillation intermittently that they didn't know about. So the plan is to try and do a larger study to really see what this new technology allows, relatively non-invasively. You just put on something like a big Band-Aid and computer chip records your heart rate.
We have to take another break here. Then we come back, we'll talk some more with Dr. Joseph Korish and Dr. Rebecca Gottesman. Before I do, a question about family history and stroke. What do we know about that?
So family history does, if you have a positive family history, particularly at a younger age, it will increase your risk of stroke. And there are some genetic components to that, and some of it could be behavioral as well, because we know that blood pressure runs in families, as do behaviors like salt intake, physical activity, smoking, etc.
410-662-8780. That's our phone number. We'll take a short break and come back and talk some more. If you have a question about this study, this large study, nearly 16,000 people, ages 45 to 64, including a group of people in Washington County, Maryland, who were in this large cohort studied from 1987 to 2011. And some good news being reported here about the continued drop in the rate of strokes in the United States and the number of people who die from them. 410-662-8780 is the number for Midday. A short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. We'll take some calls in a minute. The study we're talking about today found a 24% overall decline in first-time strokes in each of the last two decades and a 20% overall drop per decade in deaths after stroke. However, the decline in stroke risk was concentrated, this is interesting, mainly in the over 65 set, with little progress in reducing the risk of strokes among people younger than that, younger people. So I just wanted to talk a little bit more about that. Dr. Korish, this is your concern as you see coming, whatever progress has been made here being offset by, the word epidemic has been used by epidemiologists from your school, from the Bloomberg School, for obesity. So that is the next concern, right?
Yeah, I think definitely in terms of cardiovascular disease in this country, which mainly comprises heart disease and stroke, we've made tremendous gains. But unfortunately, because of diet and physical activity, we know that obesity is increasing. And we've not been able to stop it in the US, and we've actually not been able to stop it globally. And there's a real risk that some of the gains will get reversed. And
because
also,
with obesity comes hypertension, for one thing, right?
With obesity comes hypertension, diabetes, increased risk of high cholesterol, following heart attacks. And if you treat all the risk factors, you may mitigate the risk of stroke and heart attack, but you may still get to heart failure and disability. So primary prevention really is best. So we really need to keep an eye out. And we're seeing obesity at younger and younger ages, which are leading to younger and younger complications.
Let's go to the phone lines to take some questions for our guests. Jane in Randallstown, we'll go to you first. Thank you for calling. Hi, go right ahead, Jane.
Yes, I was wondering about, I believe they're called TAIs, what were commonly small strokes. Was this considered at all in your study?
That's a great question. I think you're referring to TIAs, which are transient ischemic attacks. So TIAs are very similar to strokes. They're actually strokes that threaten to happen but don't quite happen. So people often call them mini strokes or small strokes.
Do you have the fast symptoms with them?
You often have the fast symptoms, but they go away and they don't leave a mark on the brain. So a stroke, you have symptoms that either last for over 24 hours, or if they last for less than 24 hours, you can still see a mark on brain imaging, such as with a CAT scan or an MRI. And actually, just in the past year, there have been new definitions of stroke that have been published that really emphasize that we see things on the MRI, then it's a stroke. A TIA, it looks just like a stroke, and in many cases, it's an indication that someone's at risk for having a stroke.
Excuse me. It looks just like a stroke to you or me, or it looks just like a stroke on a scan?
No, that's a great point. Not on a scan. So it looks just like a stroke to you or me.
Okay.
But it does not leave a mark, and the symptoms go away. But that tells us that person is at risk for having a stroke. So that tells us we need to figure out why this happened. Is it because their blood pressure isn't adequately controlled? Is it because they have AFib that we're not treating? Is it because they have a blockage in their carotid artery that needs to be addressed? Those are things that we evaluate for when someone has either a TIA or a stroke, and then we treat them accordingly to make sure we're preventing a stroke or another TIA. In this particular study that we're talking about, we did not include TIAs within our number of strokes. And the reason why is they are harder to be confident about when we review these cases. So I'm one of the reviewers for this study, for ARIC, where we review medical records from hospitals located near these four sites. And it's very hard to know with confidence that a TIA is really a TIA as opposed to something else that looks like a TIA.
So you just eliminated them from the study.
Exactly. They're not included as strokes.
So the study covered real strokes.
Real strokes.
Okay, real strokes. Not that that isn't a real stroke, but this is you have more confidence in these because of the way they're reported.
Right. And it's a slightly different. Most people that report TIAs call them something different. They say these are TIAs and these are strokes. They don't mix them together, but we don't report on the number of TIAs here.
410-662-8780. We'll go to Chris in Aberdeen next. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hi. I had a stroke about 2 years ago, or at least I think maybe it was after hearing this TIA comment. It may have been that. But I didn't have any of the fast symptoms. I had mostly balance issues. I was walking through the grocery store and I just sort of misstep a little bit. I drive a stick shift. I shifted, and then I missed my steering wheel, and I reached for it. So it took them some time to figure out what that was. I had an MRI. I had a CAT scan. They finally had to put dye in there to figure out that it was a little artery in the back of my neck that had gotten clogged. I had exerted myself, and apparently I had torn the interior lining of that artery, and the clot that formed was what caused that. And, yeah, they put me on Coumadin. And I was in for about a week. I'm okay now. I have minor balance issues once in a great while, but I guess that qualifies as a stroke. It's just something people should be aware of as well.
Chris, how old were you when this happened?
56.
56. And how are you feeling these days?
Like I say, once in a great while, I will do a little misstep, just a little off balance. If I'm walking and I look up while I'm walking, I will lose my balance a little bit, and I have some, I can't detect temperature in my left leg, oddly enough, for whatever it's worth.
Interesting. Chris, thank you very much for calling. People report some of these odd symptoms and suspect or worry that they're strokes?
Yeah, and I'll let Dr. Gottesman expand as well, but the brain's a complex organ, and any lack of blood supply to any part can create different symptoms. So the FAST criteria are to simplify and come up with the most common presentations, but balance is an important part of the brain, and clearly in the back of the brain, that's exactly where one would expect these kinds of issues. But this caller also gives a great example that not every stroke is catastrophic, and with good treatment and care, people can do well for a long period of time.
Sure. And Chris, it sounds like you may have had what's called a vertebral artery dissection from what you're describing, which is one of these causes of stroke that we see more disproportionately more in younger people, but it's less frequently a cause in older people.
A VAD?
A VAD is we sometimes call it that.
Sorry. But not say it again.
A vertebral artery dissection. Or a dissection you can get of the carotid artery or a vertebral artery. Mm-hmm. It is, relatively speaking, a rare cause of stroke. In younger people who aren't getting strokes from these other causes that we've talked about, it disproportionately causes more strokes in younger people. It's one of the other rarer causes that's treated often with anticoagulation, as was described by the caller.
And common in younger people.
It's not that it occurs necessarily more in younger people, but out of the total number of strokes, it accounts for a larger proportion of them because they're not having strokes from the other more classic causes that we see in older people.
Let's take another call. Dana in Lutherville with a question for our guests, Dr. Rebecca Gottesman and Dr. Joseph Koresh.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering, if the person's having a stroke, is it better to take them to the closest emergency room or drive a little further to go to a special stroke center?
That's a great question. And often the 911 EMS system is now set up to bring people to primary stroke centers. The problem is so it doesn't have to be one of these special comprehensive stroke centers. There are many primary stroke centers now in the area that all have fulfilled a certain set of requirements. We know that they give appropriate care. They have 24/7 available assessment of people who are experiencing a stroke, and they can give TPA. It is critical to get to a place where they can treat you appropriately. So calling 911, and they will bring you to the closest place that they know to be a primary stroke center, is the best way to proceed if that were to happen.
Yeah, and the reason for that is the amount of time it takes. You want to apply the blood clot dissolving agents within a few hours, right? So you're delaying by a few minutes to get to a center that will give you the treatment rapidly is worthwhile.
Could you talk a little bit about the effect on memory or memory loss that might occur as a result of stroke and stroke and its connection to dementia?
Absolutely. So stroke is one of the outward signs that we see of many of these vascular risk factors that we've talked about. But we know that the same vascular risk factors can cause changes in the brain that might not present with weakness, facial drooping, speech difficulty, balance problems, any of these stroke-like symptoms. The problem is these silent strokes, as we call them, can accumulate over time and probably aren't really that silent. So they're called silent, but many of these over time can cause problems with people's thinking and memory and can lead to dementia. So although the primary cause of dementia in this country is Alzheimer's disease, it turns out that many cases of Alzheimer's disease probably have a mixed pathology. That means that some are just look like Alzheimer's, if someone had an autopsy, for instance. And many of them also have some component of strokes or vascular disease, even if they didn't know that they had it. So we know that it's very important for the cognitive health of people to keep their vascular risk factors under control, not just because of what we see when they have a stroke, because we know strokes also can impact cognitive performance and dementia, but also things that we can't see in the brain that we know contribute to worsening cognition. We're actually studying this now in this ARIC study. I'll let Dr. Koresh talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, please do. This is when you refer to ARIC again, that is an abbreviation for the title of this large study that we've been discussing in this hour, a paper about which is published in the Journal of the American Medical Association this week. Our two guests are co-authors of that study, Dr. Koresh.
Yeah, so now in our study, because of a lot of advances in medical care, the older population often survives some events or just lives for a long time with an accumulation of disease in the blood vessels all over the body, and the brain is particularly important. And we've become quite interested in the last 5 years in focusing on whether the vascular changes in the brain can be the key to improved prevention of dementia. Hmm. And the part that's hard is that most treatment studies only last 3 or 5 years. So if you want to prevent a stroke, if you treat blood pressure, you can prevent the stroke within a couple of years and not have stroke occurs. But it may be that events like dementia are not just like one major stroke. They may be hundreds of tiny little events that accumulate over decades, in which case we may need to treat the blood pressure and control it well for 10 to 20 years.
To really know.
Yeah. But it could be a secret to improving and reducing our societal risk for dementia. So we need very long-standing studies, and therefore we were trying to use the ARIC study in this context. And it seems to be working. We've had
so using the same cohort that you started with in the 80s?
Exactly. Because what happens is if you look at blood pressure in a 75-year-old, they may have already had the blood pressure change, and it was really the blood pressure for the last 25 years that was important.
Yeah. So is this another aspect of the study that's going on now?
Yeah. In fact, right. It's become one of the larger aspects of the study that focuses on heart disease, but now we have a major component on the brain. And together with Dr. Gottesman, Dr. Tom Mosley at Jackson, Mississippi, the Mayo Clinic, we've completed 2,000 brain MRIs, and we've completed over an hour of cognitive testing, word recall, drawing diagrams, retracing things to check your brain status on over 6,000 people.
I'm just impressed by this. Give me a moment. It's not just like you're looking at statistics, looking at files that go through the CDC and then come to Hopkins. And you have people, graduate students? Who does this? Actually making phone calls, interviewing people? getting the details of case by case. This is really impressive to me.
Yeah, so I think it is neat how these studies happen, and we're excited by it as well. So first of all, we have to thank the participants, right? In many ways, right, it means that somebody volunteered once in the 1980s and was told that we may keep our relationship for 20-some years, and we have. And it's amazing. People are willing to volunteer for over 6 hours. Now, of course, we and our staff take that very much to heart, and, you know, they get a car that drives them to our place, they get a snack, the facility's all set up. They are volunteers that are contributing. They get their own information back, but they're really contributing to science and future generations.
And here in Maryland, it was done at the Comstock Center in Hagerstown.
That's right. And we have a facility on Dual Highway that has about 12 exam rooms and a staff of about 20 to 30 people. And then the staff are very dedicated to collecting extremely high quality data, and they get checked in terms of quality control and repetition. And then once the data are produced, they're then disassociated and separated from the name. So we have research data. And then the research data is disseminated back to the universities, including Johns Hopkins, where in Baltimore we have approximately 100 people, including about one-third faculty and two-thirds graduate students working on a wide range of papers. And this paper in particular, I'd like to thank Dr. Sylvia Cotone, who's the incoming chair of the Department of Nursing at Tel Aviv University. And she spent 6 months with us.
She was visiting at Hopkins.
That was a sabbatical. Mm-hmm. And for a sabbatical, she worked long hours to help produce this paper.
Is she the lead author of the paper?
She is the lead author on this paper, together with a graduate student who did a lot of the statistics, another programmer, myself and Dr. Gottesman, and three other faculty members from North Carolina, Jackson, Mississippi, and another university.
Minneapolis?
He was originally at Minneapolis.
He moved
to Arizona.
Hey, we're short of time. I want to get another question in from one of our listeners, Catherine in Baltimore. Go right ahead, Catherine.
Yes, I'm calling to see if there's been any connection between stroke and Parkinson's. I know two people who developed Parkinson's after their stroke, my brother being one of them.
Dr. Gottesman?
Sure. So Parkinson's disease is a condition that's normally due to neurodegeneration and not related to stroke. However, stroke is all about real estate. This was mentioned earlier that it depends where you have the lack of blood flow. If the part of the brain that controls that is responsible for control of movements is affected by a stroke, people can have Parkinsonian symptoms related to that and have a Parkinson's syndrome. It's not exactly the same as Parkinson's disease that gradually progresses. For instance, what you see with, I obviously don't know the details about Muhammad Ali or other people in the public arena who have Parkinson's disease, but those are more progressive neurodegenerative types of conditions. If a stroke is in the right place, it can cause symptoms like Parkinson's.
Dr. Gottesman, I want to thank you for being here today. Dr. Rebecca Gottesman, Associate Professor of Neurology at Johns Hopkins, who is a co-author of this study we've been discussing today, along with Dr. Joseph Koresh, the G.W. Comstock Professor of Epidemiology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. You can find out more information about the study, read more about it on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Their paper based on this study, this extensive study, a 24-year study, is published this week in the Journal of the American Medical Association. This has been most informative and interesting. I thank you both for being here. Dr. Gottesman, Dr. Koresh, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. That's our first hour of midday. We'll take a break now for lunch. On Wednesday, lunch is provided by Apples and Oranges Fresh Market, offering breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Its catering menu includes deli and sandwich platters, fruit and cheese plates, and desserts. Apples and Oranges Fresh Market is up on North Broadway, 1900 North Broadway, up from Johns Hopkins. More information at applesandorangesmarket.com. We thank them for lunch for our guests. A short break here. Coming up, we got the news from NPR and then the second hour of our show.